Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode this week honoring three amazing veterans who spent a combined 307 years on this planet, but whose lives easily could have been cut short during World War II. When it comes to the 13 American lives tragically lost this week in Afghanistan, we will never know what those 10 Marines, 2 soldiers, and 1 Navy corpsman might have done with the rest of their lives. But in William Sanchez, whose memories you just heard, in Stu Headley, whose memorial service on the USS Midway this week brought glowing tributes, and in Jack Perrin, who we're going to focus on in a moment, there are three powerful examples of the kind of difference, the kind of impact, the kind of legacy those who do survive can pass on to the rest of us. All three of them dealt with devastating loss during the war. Jack Perrin was laid to rest in Southern California earlier this month, not too long after celebrating his 105th birthday. Jack had competed in football and track and field at UCLA, rubbing shoulders with stars like Jackie Robinson and Kenny Washington. And while his young bride, Lorraine, contributed to the war effort by working at the Douglas Aircraft Factory in Santa Monica, Jack was sent by the Navy to Pearl Harbor, where he would ultimately engage in secret work that would yield some very significant public results.
And on the ship, they had me reading the code. Maybe we'd get messages from other people, and I would help them to decipher them and put them in English. Because of that, I think they put me in the Naval Intelligence. They shipped me to Hawaii, and we started off, three actually, ended up doing it, going around checking on people and bad guys and good guys in Hawaii. At this point, we went to work at the Halekulani Hotel, which was owned by a big Navy officer. But that didn't last very long. We had 10 days of heaven, going to the four shows and everything else in Hawaii. But after about a week, they called us in and said, well, you three guys are going down someplace else. Pack your bags, get in the station wagon. And we did, and went down to the submarine base. And we were both, all three, went in to be inspected. And it was in a secret passageway, kind of, in the basement. We went back down there, and it was a kind of a dungeon place with a special guard and all that, and it turned out to be a very secret place. It was where they were reading the Japanese code, so it was obviously a very secretive place. And we sneak down there. We go down the basic tunnel, another drop down, and you go in the basement of another building that was there. There was a senior officer in charge. He had and a couple other officers around, but there wasn't too many people. And there were about a half a dozen men breaking codes.
Let me bring you right back there in a minute, but I do have another question, because you're arriving there in Hawaii about 6 months after the Japanese arrived in that surprise attack.
We were there in April.
So I'm guessing that you could still see evidence of what had happened in December. What were some of the things you saw, and was it jarring to you? Could you see the Oklahoma, the Arizona?
Oh, yeah, you could see all that. I didn't go out. I didn't go on a boat and look at them, but I could see them, something sticking up. And I knew, I was aware, of course, that they've been sunk with a lot of men. And then I had another one, but most of the men got off, and they were the band of one of the battleships, and the band got off.
I'm just curious, because here you are. If I do the math, you're 25 years old. This war has started, and now you're at the place where it began, and you're seeing something that I imagine might be a little sobering. When you see a battleship upside down or sunk and you know how many lives were lost, can you help us understand what kind of emotions maybe that produced in you?
I can't recognize that I had emotions. I think maybe I've been getting used to things that didn't bother me.
And you mentioned the band. So you're talking about the USS Maryland, which is another battleship that was damaged at Pearl Harbor, and Some of the bandsmen actually ended up working in that code room with you?
Absolutely. They worked with the translators. There were about 5 translators, about 3 of them working all the time, reading the Japanese code. There's a certain technique in reading codes and breaking them down, and they were very good at it. And they absorbed both of the music guys that had been on the battleship Maryland, and so most of the band went with our unit, but it was divorced from our unit, but it was part of our unit, you know what I mean.
And this was Hypo?
Yeah. Well, Roford was commanding officer of the unit. And he was a Mustang, which means he did not go to the academy. The regular Navy people in Washington criticized him, but they wanted to have the glory of some of the success we had.
Well, and I want to talk about some of that success you had, but first, maybe you can just help us understand. So this is in the basement of the administration building at Pearl Harbor.
In the basement.
And this is secret work that you guys are doing. So how far did you carry that secrecy? Were you allowed to tell any of your friends that this is what you were doing, or tell your wife that this is you were doing?
Oh, God, no.
No.
Very, very secretive.
Uh-huh.
This is breaking the Japanese code. We broke their code, and they didn't know we had done it. We could read the Japanese stuff, and they couldn't read ours, theoretically. I think they probably did read some of ours anyway.
I'm curious about the secrecy element. I'm sure you and your wife are writing letters back and forth. What did she think you were doing out there?
Well, every letter she got had things cut out. She didn't know anything about doing.
The censors took some scissors to it?
All my mail was censored, and it was cut out or erased or something.
You know, so many of the vets that I've interviewed were in a plane, you know, flying against the enemy, on a ship in battle with the enemy, in a foxhole watching artillery come in. Here you are in a basement at Pearl Harbor. Did you have a sense of the gravity or importance of your work, and that maybe even lives depended on whether or not you did your work well?
Oh, we understood about the work pretty well, because, I mean, it was so secret and it was so important, because we were reading the code. Let's say it says a 15-20 ship convoy of Japanese coming from down south somewhere, and they're coming up to hugging the coast for safety, and they're coming right back up to Tokyo. We'd get some of those kind of things. So we could set our submarines out, and maybe that'd be my watch. Let's say it's midnight, and I'm the only one on watch. If a message comes through, I'd have to send the message out to our submarine.
So when you say a message comes in, is that a message coming in plain English, or is that encoded?
Well, it could be encoded. Let's say a message comes in Kana alphabet. And the Khan alphabet is, of course, the Japanese alphabet. Mm-hmm. But then we've broken the code so we can read it. Some of them. We have four or five translators that are working on that. And these translators are people, including our commanding officer in my unit. They lived in Japan to learn the customs and to do it. I was very impressed by that. The fact that they had arranged ahead of time to watch out for it.
That there are people that have been living in Japan before the war who then could put that knowledge to
use. The Navy places men in key positions where they can learn things that will help them at the time of war. That's what came through to me, and it was very good. These were men like Mike Skipper, Roquefort. He was able to communicate in Japanese because he studied Japanese over there. So anyway, Roquefort was a very, very capable man, and he was a wonderful skipper, believe me.
So I know one of your passions has been fishing, and you even established a fly fishing academy at Silver Lake, one of your favorite spots in the Eastern Sierra. But
yeah.
It, as I understand it, from way back in 1942, you guys threw out a little bait for the Japanese. Whose idea was it to send a plain language message and see if you could get the Japanese to confirm the location of their planned attack?
That was actually, I heard them let you go. Jasper Holmes was the executive officer for our officer in charge, which was Roquefort.
And so they said that they could fake some kind of problem on Midway? The message said something about the water desalination plant failing or something?
Yeah. Roquefort sent a plain language communication that the water was Midway was no good anymore or something. The thing broke down that supplied the water.
So, I mean, this was a real creative plan to kind of sucker the Japanese into confirming that Midway was indeed the target, because otherwise the brass was going to focus the attention on one of those other spots, right?
Well, the brass wanted to go down south. Well, that was foolhardy.
And so somewhere in the codes that you had intercepted, the Japanese had been talking about a target that they referred to as AF?
AF.
So then once you kind of put out the bait about Midway having a water plant problem, then you intercept the Japanese broadcasting about AF?
Yeah, well, they just talk about a water problem, but it didn't have it. They just talked about it.
Yeah, but I understand that even after that, so basically the Japanese have confirmed in your minds there at Hypo that Midway is the target, but Roquefort still had a hard time convincing Washington that that was the case.
Well, I don't think he had too hard a time because he would feed it to Nimitz, and Nimitz would carry the ball.
So first the question is, well, where is this battle going to take place? Where are the Japanese going to concentrate their forces? And then you guys are still there at Pearl Harbor as the Battle of Midway unfolds, which we know now is a huge turning point in the war. What was it like for you as you found out, you know, you kind of got a play-by-play, as it were, about what was happening at Midway?
Everything we did, I thought we were on the upper hand.
Was there any kind of reaction, celebration among your fellow Hypo personnel when you all got word of what really turned into a great American victory at Midway?
Well, everybody was very happy, but in wartime, you don't get very happy about it, anything, really. It's part of the job, and you get it done, and you're pleased about it.
Well, let's talk about Admiral Yamamoto.
Oh, yeah.
You've given a few talks about your war experience, and I'm sure people have asked you, who was Admiral Yamamoto, and what did you guys have to do with him?
Yamamoto was the head of the whole Japanese Navy. He spent a lot of time in the United States. He got shot down because we broke the code that he was coming on the inspection tour. This is after Guadalcanal. He was a...
Well, maybe we approach it this way. So the code-breaking work that you're doing continues long after Midway. And Midway, you trick the Japanese into giving away the location of their attack. So instead of them surprising the Americans kind of surprise the Japanese. But you're continuing to work on this Japanese code to decipher it, and it gets to the point where you guys have a pretty good handle on it, and you're able to intercept a message that's saying exactly where Yamamoto is going to be. And you actually have that message, right?
Correct. We had the message. We knew he was going to be flying, making a survey of the different stops where they had outposts. They broke that down, the fact where it was and so forth, and that made it very easy for us. Not easy, but advantageous.
I'm going to try to read this here because I have a picture of it because you've held on to this. It says, on 18 April, Combined Fleet will visit in accordance with the following schedule. And it says, you know, depart at 0600 in a medium attack plane escorted by 6 fighters. And it goes on and on. And I'll put a picture of this online at hometownheroesradio.com. But you guys have a clear, perfect picture of where the architect of the Pearl Harbor attack is going to be flying.
Correct.
How did you guys obtain that? How did you figure that out?
Because he put out his itinerary. He was going to make a stop at different spots where they have outposts. He would stop and say hello and go on the next one, inspection tour. So he was vulnerable to something being read.
So because your office was able to intercept that message, you pass it along, and ultimately the Army Air Corps sends 16 P-38s up after them and took care of business, huh?
Correct.
Yeah, so as I understand it, this is something that Admiral Nimitz and Admiral Halsey discussed, whether they should go ahead and take Yamamoto out, and they decided to do it. So then those P-38s go after him, and there's actually a pilot by the name of Rex Barber who shot him down. I guess what I'm curious for you is, as someone who is there at Hypo, working in the basement all this time while the war is going on all over the world, getting the news of that, was there some significance to that when you find out, hey, they were able to take out Yamamoto because of what we learned?
It would feed the intelligence of them. I was down in the dungeon. Down in the basement of the building.
Did that work ever get monotonous when you're looking at numbers and letters and blocks of letters day and night?
No, because each one was different. It was exciting, really. It was exciting, and you knew you were doing something very constructive, and you were defending your commanding officer because you thought he was doing such a great job. Breaking the code was so helpful to them. The Japs had no idea we were breaking their code. They thought it was so confusing to us that they weren't worried about it. That was the impression I got.
After leaving the Navy, Jack Perrin followed his stepfather as the president of Towel Saver Incorporated, which revolutionized the hand towel dispenser industry. Jack's autobiography, On a Roll, details much of that journey. But in his last decade of life, his pride and joy was the Fly Fishing Academy he established for young people at Silver Lake in California's Sierra Nevada.
I started this program with the young kids, getting them involved and teaching them how to fly fish and all that. Once a year, the fellow that runs the camp there sets it up. We do a great job. We take all the young kids around 15, 16 years old. Like to get them around at age 14 to 15, better. And we teach them how to fly fish. We have a couple of instructors. A lot of people come and watch and help, and they help. We bring 18, I think, in. We have the guides, and the guys take them out fishing, and we supply the shoes, wading pants, and a helmet, and glasses. So we watch it pretty carefully. It's my baby. I started it, and I just love it.
He loved it till his dying day at age 105, and that Silver Lake Fly Fishing Academy is one piece of Jack Perrin's legacy that will certainly carry on. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, some of the more memorable tributes at a very special memorial service this week in San Diego for Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley. You've heard Stu share his story here on Hometown Heroes, but you're going to hear what some who knew him best had to say about him this week when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.